when the web was still young, just as blogging was becoming popular and e-commerce was taking over, cybersecurity became a mainstream topic. Those with devious intent found it quite easy to construct a robot or write up a script to flood these new spaces. Soon, bloggers found their comment sections overwhelmed with spam, and online retailers like Ticketmaster discovered that scalpers could purchase thousands of concert tickets in just minutes, which they could then flip for a hefty profit on the black market. Someone had to do something. Someone had to separate the humans from the robots. And that's where today's guest comes in. Luis von Ahn has been called one of the 50 best minds in science, one of the 10 most brilliant scientists, one of the 50 most influential people in science and technology, so on and so forth. He's a professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University. He was also one of the minds behind the CAPTCHA. You know, those squiggly little words you have to type out before you set up a new email account or buy tickets online.
So I was one of the people who invented that in the team and came up with the name as well. Now they're used all over the place. I mean, the reason that thing is there is to make sure that you, the entity filling out the form, are actually a human and not some sort of computer program that was written to submit the form millions and millions of times. And the reason it works is because humans can see these squiggly, distorted characters, but computers can't do it very well. So for example, in the case of Ticketmaster uses these things whenever you're going to buy tickets for a concert, you have to type a CAPTCHA. And the reason they use it is to stop scalpers from buying millions of tickets two at a time. So, you know, to stop the scalpers from writing a program that buys millions of tickets two at a time. Maybe 3 years ago or so, we did a little back of the envelope calculation of how many CAPTCHAs were typed every day by people around the world. You know, I type a CAPTCHA roughly once every 3 days or so because I use the internet very heavily. And if you add it all up, it's like 200 million times a day. Somebody around the world types a CAPTCHA and that happens 200 million times a day.
Wow.
Now, when I first heard this number, I was really proud of myself. I thought, look at the impact that my research has had. But then I started feeling bad because the thing is, each time you type a CAPTCHA, essentially you waste 10 seconds of your time. And if you multiply that by 200 million, you get that humanity as a whole is wasting like 500,000 hours every day typing these annoying CAPTCHAs. So then we started thinking, is there any way in which we can channel this effort for something that's good for humanity? This is 500,000 hours. And during those 10 seconds while you're typing a CAPTCHA, your brain is doing something awesome. Your brain is doing something that computers cannot yet do. You know, you're just doing a little, by definition, this is a task that humans can do, but computers can't. And the answer to that is yes. And so this is what we've been doing for the last 2 or 3 years. This is a new project. We launched it, it's like 2 years ago, called ReCAPTCHA, where the idea is this. When you type out a ReCAPTCHA now, not only are you authenticating yourself as a human, but in addition, you're helping us digitize books. So the idea is, there's a lot of projects out there trying to digitize books, like Google's trying to do that, and Amazon's now trying to do that. There's all these projects trying to digitize books. And the way they work is, you take these old books, things that were written before the computer age, and you scan them. And now scanning a book is like taking a digital photograph of every page of the book. The next step in the process is that the computer needs to be able to decipher all the words that are in the photograph, in the scan. That's so that you can search through the books. The problem, that's done using a technology called OCR for optical character recognition. And the problem with that is that it's not perfect. For older books, because the ink has faded, the computer cannot recognize a lot of the words. So what we're doing now is we're taking all the words that the computer cannot recognize in the book digitization process, and we're giving them to people in the form of a CAPTCHA to type whenever they're, for example, buying tickets on Ticketmaster.
So every word that the OCR system can't recognize as a piece of text, It then gets thrown out to
somebody buying tickets on Ticketmaster or getting a Facebook account or getting a Twitter account or whatever. With this method, we are helping to transcribe something like 60 million words per day. By just having people type them.
And are people just don't even realize this? People are typing in the CAPTCHA.
The vast majority of people don't realize this, although we don't try to hide it. I mean, if you go to, for example, any of the sites that use this, the vast majority of them include an explanation, and there's always a link. So it's, you know, there's a tagline that says stop spam, read books, and there's a little link that says learn more. And so for some of them, you have to click a link to learn more. For some of them, you don't even have to click a link. It's right there. It says, you know, you're helping to digitize books one word at a time, and there's a little blurb explaining it. But my guess is that the vast majority of people have no idea. I mean, they just, you know, they're just trying to buy their tickets or whatever.
Was this an easy program to get, you know, places like Ticketmaster and Twitter and Google on board with?
It was much easier than we thought. It turned out that we just made a very, very good CAPTCHA. I mean, most everybody had made their own version of a CAPTCHA by then, and we just made a very good one. And because of that, and it was free. I mean, we gave it out for, you know, some websites could use it for free, because the reason we give it out for free sort of thing is because we were using the results to digitize books, right? So that's useful for us. Yeah. So a lot of websites very quickly adopted it, and Facebook was one of the first few ones that adopted it. And now there's something like maybe 170,000 websites are using it.
And this actually is something funny that I heard recently, is that a lot of people, the devious types, the spammers, are using Amazon's Mechanical Turk, which is a digitally distributed pennies per task kind of job site, to get people to go out and enter in these CAPTCHAs.
So this is happening. This basically just shows how effective the CAPTCHAs are. I mean, that means that they really can't write a program to do this, so they have to go and pay people to do it. So it's costing them some money. But they are definitely doing it. It's all over the place. The good thing is nowadays, you know, if the spammer is paying somebody to type a CAPTCHA, which in turn is being used to digitize books, it's the spammers are helping the book digitization process. So your spam dollars are being used to digitize books.
That's what's so funny about this to me, is that this is something that you would normally have to pay somebody to transcribe these books, and you found another way around it. And then by extension, somebody else is paying to do this.
Spammers are definitely paying to do this, which is great.
So what other kinds of challenges have you encountered with the CAPTCHA system? Is there anything on the horizon that you still have to deal with to make this work?
I mean, it's working pretty well right now. There's a lot of things that you have to deal with when you do this. One of the things that few people realize is CAPTCHAs are actually bad for blind internet users. So there's a lot of people who use the internet that are blind. Actually, before working on this project 10 years ago, I had no idea that visually impaired people use the internet. I had no idea about that, but it turns out they do, and they use screen readers. They use these programs that read the entire screen to them out loud. Whenever there's a CAPTCHA, you know, the squiggly characters there, and there's an image of squiggly characters, the screen reader cannot read the CAPTCHA because the screen reader is a program itself, and the CAPTCHA was designed not to be read by a program. So blind people get completely blocked out when they see a CAPTCHA. The way around this, and this is what we've done with reCAPTCHA, is to also have an audio version of the CAPTCHA. So the idea is, instead of giving you squiggly letters that you have to type, we give you basically an audio clip with some distorted text, distorted voices saying some stuff, and you have to type it. We want to use this, but for transcribing audio snippets. So the idea is we're now going to be giving people, in the form of an audio CAPTCHA, little bits of audio that somebody needs to transcribe, but that voice recognition systems could not recognize. So we take all the snippets and then give them to people.
Are the programs getting any smarter with tackling the CAPTCHAs at all?
They are. They're definitely. It's funny. When we started working on the CAPTCHA project a while ago, We realized that CAPTCHAs were this funny win-win situation, which was, okay, we're going to make a CAPTCHA, and we're going to put it out there. If it's not broken, so if computers can't recognize it, then it's good. It stops spam. But if a spammer can come up with a way to break the CAPTCHA, then that's also a win. That means a spammer just improved the state of the art in artificial intelligence. And we're definitely seeing that. So spammers are actually getting a lot better at artificial intelligence, so making computers actually recognize the distorted characters better. So we're seeing that, but I'm very happy about that. I mean, that means there's more people working on making computers smarter.
Right, that's actually a blessing in disguise.
Yes.
In that this is something we've been trying to crack for years. And so how could these kinds of artificial intelligence systems be used for a productive purpose as opposed to just cracking CAPTCHAs on a ticket?
Oh man, I mean, the idea here is they'll be able to write a program that can read text a lot better. I mean, if there's such a program, we can digitize books faster, or we can do all kinds of things. We can improve search engines, because now they can look inside images. See, right now, search engines can't look inside images for text. Not very well, at least. But if we had a method that can read all kinds of distorted text, the search engines could look inside the images. So they could improve. We could have your phone could be more accurate at telling you, you know, you could take a picture of something, like a book, and it could read like the title of it and tell you something about the book.
And that's actually something that has already been put into app form on iPhones and Androids, that you can take a picture of a product on the shelf and then find out the price
comparisons.
That's
right. Now, the way that works right now is usually with the barcode. But for things that don't have a barcode, that doesn't work very well. It almost doesn't work, in fact. But if we had a program that can read text better, you know, sort of from any angle or anything, you could use it for other things, not just things that have a barcode.
If the computers are getting smarter, they're able to take over these jobs that we had developed these systems for humans for humans to do. Mm-hmm. How do you tell the difference?
That's a very good question. I think there will be a day. This is not anytime soon. I think we're talking in, you know, more than 10 years from now, where computers will be able to do most everything that most humans can. I mean, the problem, for example, with CAPTCHAs, this needs to be a task that, you know, 99% of the population needs to be able to do. We can't start asking you to solve mathematical equations or stuff like that, just because then most people won't be able to buy tickets on Ticketmaster, right? So we need to have a task that is very, you know, the baseline is very low. It has to be the case that most everybody can do it. I believe that, you know, within a number of years, maybe 10, maybe 20 years, computers will be able to do most everything that a large fraction of the human population can do. I think that'll happen.
And so our ability to distinguish for these security purposes alone is like
it's going to go away.
Big deal.
Yep, that's going to go away. So we need to come up with other ways. Fortunately, I think we're 10, 15 years away from that. And if you think about how things have changed in the last 10 years or the last 15 years, you know, 15 years ago, there was really pretty much no World Wide Web. I mean, it existed, but really there wasn't. So this is how much things have changed in the last 15 years. Just imagine how much are going to, you know, this is, we're talking now here. 2025.
Well, so you work at Carnegie Mellon, which is at the forefront of this kind of research. So it's really up to you guys over there to figure this out.
We're trying. You know, one really big question that I've always had, and I think a lot of people have, but there's no very good answer really. And I wish somebody would sit there and think about this. You guys should think about this. Is what the hell is going to happen when computers can do everything that humans can? Or most everything that humans can. You know, forget about love or whatever. Yeah, I don't want to talk about that. Just stuff like most every job that humans can do. What's going to happen? Okay, so here's the question. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I'm not even sure. I mean, you could say that it's a bad thing, right? We're going to be out of a job. But you could say it's a good thing because humanity is always going to become so much more productive that, because, you know, you could just replicate these things and just get them to do work 24 hours a day as opposed to just 8 hours a day. And so everybody's going to be so much more productive, humanity as a whole. So maybe, you know, we're going to be able to eradicate hunger or just we're going to be so much more productive at everything that we're not going to have a problem at all. So I don't know which one is actually the truth here. And somebody really should give. I have never heard a very good answer about this, whether this is good or bad.
And so are you of any mind on it?
I'm hoping it's good. I don't see. I mean, I'm hoping it's good. But I don't know. It's hard to. It's very hard to plan for these things, right? I mean, another thing is this is unstoppable, right? It's not like we're gonna. This is gonna happen. Right? It's not like we should. It's not like there. We should come up with a law like, you know, the not doing research on stem cells or whatever. I don't think anybody's gonna be able to come up with a law that says we can't do research in computer science anymore. That, you know. For example, if the U.S. did that, they would sign their death wish in terms of economic development, right? Because every other country would take it. So nobody's going to do that. So computers are going to continue evolving. So this is unstoppable. But the question is whether this is going to be a good thing or a bad thing. And we should really figure out to plan a way such that this is a good thing.
That we can make these artificial intelligence systems and the robots and servants of us.
Servants of us, and also that the economics of it work out. That is in... actually, it's not the case that they're taking away jobs, but actually it's the case that they're really helping us, as opposed to just taking away jobs.
Luis von Ahn is a professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University. He's also one of the minds behind the ReCAPTCHA project. We spoke not long ago about how we can harness people's spare cycles, their idle or wasted moments on the web, to do good. It turns out that online gaming is another great place to harvest some energy for good.
You know, there's a lot of time being spent playing games. And a lot of times while you're playing these games, your brain is also doing something. You know, your brain is doing amazing computations while you're playing these games, things that computers could not be able to do. So the question is, can we make games that are really fun to play? And as people are playing them, not only are they getting entertained, but they're also solving tasks that computers cannot yet solve.
So what kind of tasks?
The first one that I did had to do with labeling images. So the idea is this. This is what we were getting people to do for us. Given an image, you know, it could be like a picture of a dog. Tell us descriptive keywords for that image. So in this case, it would be dog. There may be the word man because the man's walking the dog in this image. Or there may be leash, or essentially descriptive keywords that describe the image. So computers can't do this yet. And they won't be able to for the next many, many years. This is a much harder problem even than this, than recognizing distorted text.
Right.
This is a very hard problem.
At this stage, we've got computers that can recognize a pixel and tell you what color it is, basically.
Yeah, they can do a few things. They can they can recognize colors. They can tell you, they can spot faces relatively well. They, you know, they can't tell you whose face it is very well, but they can at least say that's probably a face.
It's probably a face.
Yeah, so that's about the state of the art. I mean, anything else that you ask, you know, even asking whether to get a computer to determine whether something's a dog or a cat, can't do it. There's no computer program that can tell you whether an image contains a dog or not on the internet. So the way image search works is by using file names. So if you search for dog, you get back a lot of images that somebody named dog.jpg.
Right.
Clearly, this is not the best method, right? I mean, in the sense that, first of all, when do you name an image something that's properly descriptive? I mean, the vast majority of my images are called image one.
Right.
And that's most people's images. And also, there's nothing to guarantee that your images, that you named your images correctly. I mean, how do I know that you don't have a dog that's named Bunny, for example, and you name bunny.jpg, and it's not a bunny, it's actually a dog.
And so you've made a game around this.
We've made a game around this. We essentially made a game that, as people are playing, they are actually labeling images for us from the internet. The game, we made this game quite a while ago. It was called the ESP game. Here's how the game works. So it's an internet game. It's like an online web game. When you go to the web, to the game, you get randomly paired with somebody else wanting to play the game. So it's a two-player game. So you go there, and you get randomly paired with somebody else. That's your partner. Now, this other person is a complete stranger from the web, right? You've never met them. You don't know anything about them. Mm-hmm. And you also cannot communicate with them. You have no idea who they are, and you can't communicate with them. And the goal of the game is for both you and your partner, who's a total stranger, to type the exact same word, given that the only thing you two have in common is that you can both see the same image. Okay, so you can both see the same image. You know you can both see the same image. And now you're told, type whatever the other guy's typing. Turns out that what people do is type a lot of words related to the image, because that's the only thing the two of them have in common. And if they type the same thing, if both players type the same thing, they get points, and then they get a brand new image. So this is roughly how the game works.
And through that, you get comparative perspectives on
what this
image contains.
That's exactly right. And the words that they agree on are very good labels for the image, because they come from two relatively independent sources. So that was the idea of the game. We put it online, and it labeled, you know, millions of images. And now, eventually, Google actually acquired that game. So now the results are used in part to improve Google image search. So some of the results come from basically people having used the game.
So what other examples of crowdsourced games have you guys been working on?
There's a lot of things. So let's see. That was images. We can do the same thing for audio clips. So like telling us about, you know, whether a piece of music is happy or sad, or it's essentially labeling audio clips. We can also do another one where not only is it telling us what objects are in the image, but where in the image each object is. So it's also pointing to, basically, you know, an image. We may know that there's a cat and a dog, but we don't know where in the image it is. So we have a game that tells us these are the pixels that belong to the cat. These are the pixels that belong to the dog. So there are those. Now there are many other people following up on this work. So different research groups and different universities are following up on this work. There's one where as you're playing the game, you're actually helping to fold proteins. So there's basically the idea is you have a lot of people who are playing a game, and as they're playing it, they're being able to find better ways of folding a protein that computers cannot yet find.
And so it seems to me that with all of these different games, you're not only creating a way for people to contribute individually to labeling an image, mm-hmm. And then having that data. These might also be ways to make programs be able to take this on for themselves.
Yes, that's
making
correct.
The programs themselves.
That's exactly
smart.
Right. So the idea is that the data that we're collecting can also be used to train the computers to become better at it. Recently, in computer science, I mean, over the last 15 years, people have discovered a lot of algorithms that can learn from examples. So the idea is you can write a program that you can teach to distinguish between cats and dogs if you give it a lot of examples of cats and dogs. Much like children learn, you know, when they're young, you tell them, this is a cat, that's a dog, this is a cat, that's a dog. The biggest difference between computers and children is, you know, children, you can probably tell them, you know, 50 times, this is a cat, this is a dog, and they'll learn forever in their life that this is a cat versus a dog, right? That's it. Whereas with a computer, you need literally millions of examples mm-hmm. to get to very high accuracy. So one of the things that these games are doing are they're collecting all these examples of images that are labeled to be able to teach computers to essentially see better.
Right, and especially if you're looking at a two-dimensional image, you need to tell the machine that, okay, well, from this perspective, it's still a dog. From this perspective,
right.
it's still a dog.
That's right. So that's why we need. That's partly why we need so many more images. I mean, kids not only probably come with some sort of innate object detection thing in their head, but they get a 3D version, so they get a much better view. I mean, 7 minutes of looking at a dog, just imagine the number of images that you get, still images. Whereas with computers, you're giving them still images, so you need a lot of them.
Have you noticed a tipping point at which an image and a set of images gets labeled before a program starts?
Yeah,
to be
there's
able
such
to
a thing. Although even yeah, I think there's also so I'm sort of oversimplifying here. I think the algorithms exist that can learn from data, that can learn from seeing a lot of images, but they're not yet that great. In the sense that once you give them millions of images, they'll get, you know, 80% accurate or something like that. I think there's not only do we need more data to get the computers to see better, but we probably also need better algorithms. It's not clear that they'll be able to get to 100% with infinite amount of data.
In the world of gaming, this seems to be kind of very, very basic games compared to what you might see somebody playing on their PlayStation or their Xbox.
Just a few things to say about that. First of all, these are very basic. That's true. But actually, if you look at number of hours spent playing games, it's not true that the more sophisticated games completely win out. You know, Solitaire and Tetris account for a very large number of hours of people playing games.
Right.
So there's a lot of...
Especially between the hours of 9 and 5. For
that's right. Yeah, yeah. No, there's just a lot of things. There's probably age differences as well. I think probably older people are more comfortable with the simpler games. That may be the case. I mean, I actually am pretty sure that's the case. Yes, there are more sophisticated games, but it's not entirely clear that the more sophisticated games get played more hours in terms of just number of hours. There's a good reason why, say, Xbox games are so complicated is because people are not willing to pay for the simpler games anymore because there's enough good free versions out there. Whereas the complicated ones, people are actually willing to pay for them. And this is why companies make the complicated games. But for our purposes, having the simpler ones is actually good enough.
Luis von Ahn is a professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University and one of the minds behind the ReCAPTCHA project. Lots of web thinkers have been dedicating time lately to the idea of harnessing human power on the web for good. Clay Shirky's recent book, Cognitive Surplus, for instance, presents dozens of examples of people brought together by the web to advance a cause. Some are more skeptical. A recent talk from Jonathan Zittrain presented a few caveats to the digitally distributed labor model. Is it ethically safe to harvest such cheap or free labor on the web? I asked Luis for his take. Regarding the ethics of these games, there have been questions raised about where this labor goes. And of course, when you're folding a protein or when you're labeling an image, you can say within a reasonable area of ethics that those are good things. You're helping to solve possibly cure a disease. Mm-hmm. But how does ethics come into this work?
Yeah, I think that ethics is a very important question here. What we do for all the projects that we've worked on is we're very clear and we don't try to hide it at all in small print or anything, exactly what the outcome is being used. I think it's very important that people are informed. Now, clearly, this could be used for nefarious purposes. I mean, clearly, somebody could come up with some, you know, something and basically just trick people to do something else and never tell them. Something somewhat similar to what needs to get done with copyright, which still sort of needs to be fixed, needs to get done with this, because the lines are very blurry about what constitutes work. I mean, most every Web 2.0 company, the stuff that the users are doing in some way could be constituted as work. I mean, when you click on a search result, when you click on dig this, when you rate a video, all of this stuff is stuff that you're doing to improve the site. So in some sense, it's being monetized. And in exchange, what you're getting is the usage of a free service, you know, a free video watching service. In exchange, you're getting something, right? But the stuff that you're doing, in some sense, can be constituted as work. I mean, these are things that normally you would have to pay people to do, to, you know, rate search results or rate which are the best videos, etc. So all that, in some weird way, can be constituted at work. So where do you draw the line about what's, you know, what's work and what's not? And also, where do you, how do you inform people of this? I mean, it's so difficult. It's not entirely clear that you can inform people. Just imagine the informed, you know, this would look like these humongous terms of service that nobody would ever read, right? We're just like, you know, whenever you click on a, whenever you rate a video, we use your results to rate videos, and we may, you know, be monetizing this in the following ways, blah, blah, blah. So it's very tough to inform everybody of this. It's not just, I mean, the examples of the stuff that I've done are very overt, sort of like, this is work, and we are turning it into games, right? But it's very sort of explicit. But a lot of the stuff that's done on the web nowadays is not as explicit. I mean, it's sort of like you do things, and as a side effect, they're getting work out of you.
You've listed some examples of the work that you're doing, and you've listed some examples of work that people do on the web without knowing it. Have you noticed any examples of work that people are doing on the web that can be interpreted as possibly nefarious?
I think probably the best one that I've seen is this one, and it's more funny than nefarious, but here's one. So a while ago, this has to do with CAPTCHAs. A while ago, there was this pornography company that was going around, instead of paying people to type the CAPTCHAs for them, they were basically giving people pornography in exchange of typing the CAPTCHAs. So they would say, hey, you want to see the next pornographic image? You got to type the word that's in the box below. And people would type it really quickly, and then they would be able to see the pornographic image. And people didn't know that those words that they were typing, I don't know what they thought, but people, I don't think, knew that those words that they were typing were actually being used to essentially spam. You know, they were creating spam accounts with those words. So they were tricking people with pornography to type CAPTCHAs all day long. So I've seen that, and that seems somewhat nefarious, but I mean, is it terrible? I don't think it's terrible. I mean, okay, fine. So they got a few spam accounts. But yeah, that's about the worst that I've seen. I don't believe it's currently a big problem. But I think definitely this needs to be thought out. I mean, there's all kinds of questions. There's all kinds of questions here having to do with ethics and policy. I mean, here's another question. Should Mechanical Turk be subject to minimum wage laws? I mean, they are getting less than minimum wage. They are employers in the United States hiring people working in the United States. The laws were made for stuff that was true 100 years ago and is no longer true. I mean, now you can do micro work. You can do little pieces of work. You know, rate a video. That's work,
yeah,
in some way. But come on. Are we really going to start giving a minimum wage law for that?
Right.
When you spent half a second rating something? This is a very good way, for example, Mechanical Turk, I don't know if I should be saying this in the air, but Mechanical Turk is a very good way for companies to get around the minimum wage, right? You just hey, you know, normally I would have to pay these people $7 an hour or whatever minimum wage is. If I go over there, there's still people in the U.S., but somehow, because they're not called my employees, I can pay them $2 an hour.
Right.
It's better for me. And they're willing to do it. What's wrong with it? They're willing to do it. So it's a funny thing, right?
Yeah, well, it'll be very interesting to see how this shakes out. And especially with the gaming aspect, it's a fascinating.
Yeah, that's another one, which is, I mean, then you're at the other end of the spectrum where you're like, you know, you can't possibly say this is a job. They're not getting paid. Right. They're just having fun. But in some way, they're also doing a job for you. So it's this, you know, that starts coming into, for example, I think unpaid internships are now illegal. So, I mean, is this an unpaid internship? So, again, I think this is something that somebody needs to really think about very carefully. Somebody who is, you know, legally oriented.
Well, it's a lot more nuanced than the exchange of money for work here, because you're dealing with a different culture on the web, or many different cultures.
Yeah, that's right.
You've got a community, and you've got a lot of kinds of exchange that is going on. In a game, you're getting enjoyment out of it.
Yeah, the other thing is, then you also get into, I mean, the web is the whole world, right? So fine, there is minimum wage laws in the US. Are there in other countries? Probably most countries, but they're not the same minimum wage. So which minimum wage should apply to you? I mean, the country that you're a citizen off, the country where you're doing it from, the country where the company's hiring you from. I don't know.
And in many cases, there aren't time limits necessarily on this task. So you could say...
So you could say, look, if they did it really fast, they could be making $20 an hour. So it's fine. They just happen to be slow. But we're a good employer, so we let them be slow. Right.
But I have yet to meet the person who makes their full, you know, life living on Amazon Mechanical Turk. Is there somebody out there? Do you think there are people out there?
I don't know that. I mean, that may be true. Way of life. That seems tough in the U.S. And if so, they have pretty crappy life in the U.S., is my guess, because the amount of money that you could make per day is pretty low. And one of the claims is that most of these people don't see this as work, or that at least a very large fraction of these people don't see this as work, but they see it as like entertainment, some weird form of entertainment. You know, the idea is, look, I could be watching 3 hours of TV, at the end of the time, I have basically just spent 3 hours, whereas I could be doing Mechanical Turk, and at the end of 3 hours, I made $5. Why not?
Well, thank you very much for taking the time today.
Sure, sure.
Luis von Ahn is a professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University. He's also one of the minds behind the Recapture Project, the ESP game, and many, many others. What do you think about digitally distributed labor and human computation? Throw us a comment over on our blog at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaBergman. While you're there, you can check out links to Luis von Ahn's work and to a recent talk he gave at the Berkman Center. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.